Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Courtney Pasak, author of The Hostess. Now, Courtney graduated with a degree in communications and journalism from Monmouth University, which I think is in Illinois. Is that in Illinois?
No, you know what? I heard there's one there, but this is actually in New Jersey.
Okay. Following with a master's degree in publishing from Pace University, she started her career at magazines such as Cosmopolitan, Self, and Modern Bride. In 2015, she wrote her first novel, 30 Days to 30, and sold thousands of copies while working as a project manager in New York. Courtney currently lives in Palm Beach, Florida, with her husband and two sons. She is a member of the Women's Fiction Writers Association, the National Writers Association, International Thriller Writers, and Mystery Writers of America. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Courtney.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm guessing that, so your first novel, 30 Days to 30, was in 2015.
Yes.
And then you published your second novel in 2025, The Tutor? Was that your second?
Yes.
And your third following right after, like really soon, The Hostess. I'm guessing that gap had something to do with the two sons?
Exactly. So I had... So I was in my 20s at the time when I wrote 30 Days to 30. I was into reading, you know, romantic comedies. And I had written this book, submitted it to agents. And this was around the time where the hype was either Twilight or 50 Shades. So I had gotten feedback from an agent who said, like, I really like this, but the market's really moving away from it. You should self-publish. And I was like, I don't know anything about, you know, it's funny, even having a master's in publishing, it still is not the same thing as like actually going through the process. So I was a little nervous about it. And then my husband finally convinced me, because my book was about resolutions and trying to, you know, kick things off your bucket list before a certain age. And he was like, you know, you should probably follow your own advice and just do it. So I did. I did really well, but it was very hard work. And again, right after the success of that, I realized because of how much work it took, I figured we were talking about having kids at the time. So I said, let's wait until they're in school. And then this way I can really give it my all. And also at this time too, I was really getting into mystery thrillers. I love puzzles. So we kind of also extended that break a bit so I could focus a little more on that genre.
And how did you learn to write thrillers? Did you take some classes, courses, or just by reading?
No, you know, I was a huge fan. And, you know, one of the best ways to write is to, you know, just read everything and deconstruct it. And, you know, you'll see all different types of books where you'll look and go, oh, I could totally write something like this. And then others you'll go, oh my gosh, this was so amazing. I would never live up to this. And you go back and forth. But, you know, eventually you do it enough. You know, again, this is not exactly my second novel. I think I've thrown out five novels in between just to, you know, teach myself, you know, what makes sense, why it's working, why it's not. And, you know, not particularly writing classes, but, you know, Writer's Digest does a thrillers conference every March that's virtual. And I love listening to other authors and their advice on how to break down the genre and, you know, ways to think about things. So that was always extremely helpful.
So Writer's Digest used to be like, well, they had the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Do they still have a magazine?
Print I'm not magazine. Sure. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not 100%.
And then they had the go-to book for that listed agents, listed publishing companies, listed, mm-hmm. you know, who you would send. This is, I mean, I'm dating myself, obviously.
No, I remember that.
And where you actually had to mail things out and you had to have the address and so forth. So it's interesting I was wondering what they had segued to now that those things are not as, you know, magazines are difficult.
Yeah, I mean, they still have a very prominent website. They have these virtual conferences and all these different genres. They have a conference every summer that, you know, I'm looking to hopefully participate in this summer as well. So they're still very prominent and giving writers the opportunity to connect with one another and as well with agents and pitching them.
Well, speaking of conferences, I saw on your website, you have a couple things, a Thriller Fest, What is that?
Thriller Fest. So I'm actually going to be a debut author, part of their debut author club this year, since this is my new genre. And but it's such a great conference. So they've broken it up. So the beginning part is a craft fest. So if you're a writer and you do want to know how to, you know, the ins and outs of writing, you go earlier in the week. They offer a pitch fest where you get to pitch one-on-one with different agents and, you know, see how you do. And then there's the Thriller Fest weekend where they highlight certain spotlight authors, but they have just also panels like where you could attend. And aside from last year, they had interviews with John Grisham and James Patterson, but then there's also panels about, you know, how to adapt to a screenplay and people that had done that and what their experience was, and, you know, how to write, domestic thrillers, or, you know, understanding horror genre, things like that.
Now, is it geared just towards writers, or is it also for fans of thrillers?
So, I mean, I think the beginning part is of the week is probably more writer focused, but, mm-hmm. you know, if you're a fan, you would meet a lot of your favorite authors at these events. There are, you know, happy hour mingling options. There's the ITW award show that they have there that you can attend. So you certainly don't have to be a writer for that part.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds interesting. And then also you have the Creepy Book Club retreat.
Yeah.
That's coming up not too long a time in February. So tell me a little bit about that.
So Emily and Ashley started this Creepy Book Club, and I believe this is their second year, if I'm not mistaken, where they've actually done a retreat. So they invite headline authors and expo authors to, you know, come, and it's going to be at the Scott Hotel, I think. Yeah, the Scott in Arizona. And it's not too far from the Poison Pen bookstore, which is, you know, a huge landmark for thriller writers. So yeah, it just gives you an opportunity to, you know, in a quiet, you know, complete opposite of Thriller Fest, which is a very big industry base. This is a little more intimate, where authors can connect with other readers on a more personal basis and, you know, get to really know their readership.
Have you done anything like that before?
So my first experience with conferences is I went to the Hamptons Whodunit in April. And for me, that was a really great starting experience, because I had the 3-book deal, but I wasn't published yet. And I attended and wound up having, you know, staying at this like small little, like not a bed and breakfast, but, you know, small enough where you go in, there's like a tiny kitchen and everyone helps themselves for breakfast. And I'm in there with Lucy Foley and Sherry LaPena and Tess Gerritsen, Casey Sherman, and everybody was just so nice and very helpful with, you know, helping me with what I should be doing as far as, you know, getting myself out there and promoting. And it was nice. It wasn't as crazy. It was a more intimate experience. So I did really enjoy that.
Oh, cool. That's very nice. We'll get back in a little bit to how you got a 3-book deal. But first, let's talk a little bit about the hostess and the premise and where the idea came from.
Sure. So the story of the hostess is about this couple, Natalie and Luke, who decide to rent this guest house on this gorgeous Southampton estate. And, you know, they no sooner get there and they meet the owner of the estate, Sadie, who lives in the big house, and her and Natalie really hit it off, which is great, because the reason they're actually there is because Natalie is recovering from a traumatic brain injury that she got from a car accident and kind of became agoraphobic in the city. So her husband was hoping, you know, having this open space would help in her healing process, but he still has to work in the city. So he no sooner leaves, and all of a sudden these weird things start happening around the house. And Natalie's a very rational person, so she's trying to explain it away and say it's the change of environment and my meds and everything. But as it gets more and more sinister, things start to happen. She starts to go, okay, who exactly is this woman? And what is she, you know, what are her secrets? What is she hiding? And that's basically the premise. And the idea is because anytime you rent, you know, renting houses now is huge for, you know, vacations. And you always have this kind of eerie feeling, like, what's going on? Like, what happened in this house before I got here? You know, I was at, for my cousin's bachelorette party. She grew up in Arlington and she wanted to have a bachelorette in Annapolis, Maryland. And so we looked at this house rental that was like right across from the Naval Academy, advertised as graduates of the Naval Academy own this house. And, you know, we clearly weren't going to be doing anything crazy. We were, you know, hiring a chef at the house and like get our nails done, but we weren't like throwing crazy parties or anything. But we get there and they had left out their laptop, like certain jewelry. And I was very weirded out by that. And one of my cousin's friends shows up and she sees this family picture and she goes, I know the wife. She goes, I'm 90% sure they're in the CIA. And we're like, oh, so no wonder, because they probably have cameras all over this house. So we were all like, please don't touch anything. Don't do anything wrong. So that was pretty funny. And then There was another time my husband and I, we rented a house in Lake Como, which is, you know, it's just straight up.
I was there in September.
Out of a house. Yeah. And we had our 2-year-old son with us. And that first night, you know, it's always really eerie because it's super quiet and you're starting to hear the house settle. And there were these really long, loud creaks like above our, you know, in the ceiling. And I was like, in my head, I start going, what if the owner never left? What if this is some like weird voyeurism and he's living up there? And my husband's like, no, don't worry about that. I'm sure more likely it's this house is about to fall off a cliff. I'm like, oh, well, thank you for reassuring me.
Wow.
But yeah, so those were the kind of things that stemmed this idea.
So what I found most interesting, I think, about the hostess is that you really didn't know which direction it was going. Was this sort of going to be a horror story? Was this going to be a, you know, there was just you know, she had a traumatic brain injury and she'd had a lot of trauma in her past. And so was it more of a, you know, psychological issue, or was it an external threat? And mm-hmm. you knew something was going on, but you really kept me wondering which direction it was going, because it seemed like there could be a supernatural aspect, there could be a medical aspect, there could be a criminal aspect.
Yeah. It had a little bit of that Riley Sager touch to it. He has to dabble in that, where you think it's a supernatural thing and then he gives you the real explanation at the end.
Yeah, and which I like that, because I mean, supernatural is cool too, but I like the fact that there can be a rational explanation for things.
Me too. That's what I
think. Supernatural. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was your writing process like? Are you a pantser or a plotter?
So I always say that I'm definitely more of a plotter, but kind of the way I was talking to Carter Wilson on his podcast not too long ago, and he's a pantser, and we were kind of comparing notes. So I might be a little in between. So I'm a plotter in the sense that I want to have a sense of direction. I want to know how it's going to end. But my plotting really is just each chapter, I just make sure that there's one scene that happens that's going to move the plot forward and include a hook that's going to keep the reader going. But other than that, I try to give, you know, I was telling him I write the first 10,000 words, which usually at that point introduces all the characters. And then I kind of sit back and go, okay, let's get, which direction do these characters want to go? What kind of personality are they going to have? And allow a little more freedom in that sense. But if I just free write, I will totally write myself into a corner.
So do you know who done it basically when you start?
Yeah. Usually. I mean, there have been times where I surprise myself and I get 3/4 of the way and go, oh, actually, never mind. This is a better way, which I'm fine with, as long as I'm bringing myself and the reader in, you know, the right direction.
Right, right. So were there things in The Hostess that surprised you as you were writing it, things the characters did or characters that appeared that you weren't, you know, didn't really plan for?
Yeah, well, so this one, to be honest, I felt like I had to write backwards, because if you know the ending, that was pretty much my hook to begin with. So the ending is what gave me the idea for the story. And so I kind of had to work around that and go, okay, well, what kind of character would be able to explain these sort of things away? And what sort of, you know, clearly there would have to be some traumatic issues in order to rationalize and things like that. So, right. There wasn't really too much of a surprise. I think, you know, maybe Riley, the caretaker, his character, probably, you know, I made him a little more rounded out than I was initially intending, which I liked the direction that it went.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so this, you said you, this was part of a 3-book deal. Are they, is there any connection between the books?
There isn't. It's kind of like a Freda McFadden, where it's just a lot in quick succession, and they're all standalones.
Okay.
But they're quick popcorn thrillers, sort of.
So how styles. Long does it take you to write one of these?
So I am unnaturally fast writer. Now, when I got my 3-book deal, I had already written the books. So what happened my agent had pitched me to this editor, Audrey, who was amazing, and she liked it so much. She said, has she written anything else? And she said she happens to have 2 more books, and she did all 3. And the succession of these books, you know, I have a UK publisher. So I have these like semi-release, like the tutor released in August of 2025. Yesterday, The Hostess released in the UK January 15th, and the next one will be I believe June 21st. Now, the only thing is I have a 3-month delay with the paperback in the US. So okay. Most of my promotion in the US is around the paperback release, but I kind of start to build momentum with the UK release. But because of how quick they come out, yeah, I try to make sure that I'm sitting at my desk and writing. So I have written 3 more books. I just sent them to my agent, and she's giving them, she's sending them around on submission now, or at least one of them right now, and then see what anyone has to say about the other 2. We still need to edit those a bit.
Okay. So, I did notice that your publisher was in the UK, and so the hardcover are they releasing hardcover in the UK, or is it all paperback?
It's paperback. They're, okay. This is a digital focused team, which is why, the releases are so quick.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So it's releasing digitally in the UK, yeah. But is that available for US audiences as well?
Oh yeah. So in the UK right now, the audio, digital, and paperback are all available at the same time.
Okay.
In the US currently for The Hostess, it's the audio and digital you could download right now and listen to or read on your Kindle. The paperback will not be available until April 21st.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So when The Tutor was released in August, you say?
Mm-hmm, so August 7th.
Has there been a, you know, has that, how's the response to that been? How has that changed your life?
The team there is doing a great job. You know, one of the things I did, so mentioned, I was on Carter Wilson's podcast last week. He was one of the first people I stalked because he happened to be coming to Florida for a writer's live event writer's live event where they, you know, he was promoting his book, and I showed up at the library a half hour earlier, sat up front, and I was like, hi. So here's my whole life story. I have a 3-book deal, but my agent and my publisher are in the UK. I don't know what I should be doing here. You know, what can I? And so he suggested getting a publicist here, which was probably one of the best decisions I ever did. And they've been doing an amazing job at really reaching out and getting me opportunities I never would be able to get on my own.
Absolutely. Okay. So why don't you read a little bit from The Hostess for us?
Okay. I'll start with chapter 1 then. Well, what do you think? I turn towards Luke, his hazel eyes bright with excitement as he anticipates my answer. He pauses at the entrance of the light gravel driveway for effect. The house itself is still another 50 yards away. I manage a smile on my face and tilt my head. It's perfect. His hand leaves the steering wheel to find mine, and he gives it a gentle squeeze. This is going to be fun. I rub my thumb over the top of his hand. For both of us, I say. He sucks in his dimpled cheeks before cocking his head at the oversized summer home. At least I don't think we'll suffer. I let out a small laugh. He's right. The house is gorgeous. A proper Southampton estate. I count 24 windows, all perfectly adorned with black shutters, just in front of a gray cedar shake house. Sadie said the guest house is on the right. Luke points as he hunches over the wheel, peering out over the front windshield. I turn and look out at the passenger window of our newly purchased black Jeep Grand Cherokee. The perfectly manicured hedges give way to display a smaller, but still sizable house, bookended between its own private swimming pool and tennis courts. Whoa, Luke says, eyes the size of sand dollars. I gaze up at the two sloping gables of the roof staring down at us like a pair of eyes. I find myself clenching and unclenching my grip on the door handle. My pulse suddenly quickens, and I'm drowning with an overwhelming sense of dread. Luke seems to notice my breathing become shallow. You okay? I drop my head. Yeah, I just need a minute. He strokes my brown hair, softly pulling down on the strands of my pixie cut until he gets to the base of my skull. He gives my tensing muscles a gentle squeeze, instinctively knowing how to calm me down. I know this has been a lot for you today. Just take your time. Thanks, I say, slightly embarrassed, even though I know I shouldn't be, not with Luke. He knows how hard it was for me to leave our apartment today. Ever since the accident, I've been terrified of cars. I don't trust being in them, and I don't trust others driving, which is particularly difficult when you live in New York City. It's made me agoraphobic over the last several months. I used to be different. I had a bright, bubbly personality. Some may say I was a social butterfly even. I was happy, and why wouldn't I be after everything that I had overcome? I have a wonderful job as a nurse practitioner, and I'm married to the love of my life. I turn towards Luke, his clean-shaven face slightly rounded, just like when we met in college, always getting carded at bars because of his boyish looks. Now he's settled into his age. His dark hair is tousled and parted on the side, still holding off any signs of gray or thinning. His broad shoulders always give him the appearance of being in shape when he doesn't have the time to put the effort in. He's just blessed with naturally good genes. If things ended between us, I know he wouldn't be single for long. I, on the other hand, feel uglier by the day. The accident did not help with things. The scars under my hair raised and still sensitive to the touch. I'm not really meant to have a pixie cut. It's just my hair growing back. I'm finally in a place where it's no longer patchy. But I used to have beautiful hair, long and silky. My favorite part of it was when Luke would pull behind my ear before kissing me. My bright blue eyes, which always gave me a striking appeal with my naturally long lashes, have dulled a bit, the signs of tragedy dimming them like the light switch. I bite my inner cheek and look up at Luke, waiting patiently for me. I inhale deeply and open the door. Luke springs out like a jackrabbit to come over and help me. It's the most exposed I've felt in a while. Being outside in an open space like this, something I haven't done in so long, feels like I've stepped into another dimension. I can smell the salty brine of the air along with freshly cut grass. I close my eyes and find myself pretending to be back in our apartment to give myself a moment of calm. I feel Luke's arm gently guide me. I can do this, I remind myself. Right before the accident, Luke had landed this amazing job at a private equity firm. Not only that, his boss, Jim, the founder of the company, took Luke under his wing. In the last 6 months, the opportunities with this position have accelerated faster than Luke could have ever hoped, putting us financially in a better situation, which we desperately needed after all the medical expenses. Earlier this week, he and I discussed, or rather he claims, that I'm stunted in my recovery because I don't leave the house. I'm better than I was before, I try to explain to him. I know you are. You have come a long way, Luke said, his hand scooping crumbs off our linoleum countertop in our small galley kitchen. But listen, I have this idea. I remember stiffening. I found this rental in the Hamptons. I stared at him confused, not quite believing it. In the middle of summer? Yes, he said, almost not believing himself, his fingers propped on the counter. This price is very reasonable, and I know that the city has made you, he trails off. I know, I admit, shifting nervously. I thought this would be a great opportunity to get you out of the city and give you some space that you need to fully heal. I didn't say anything. I just think this would be a nice escape, he paused, for both of us. My chest tightened at the implied statement. It's not just me who needs to recover, it's our marriage. So what can you tell me about this place? I tried to act more enthusiastic. Luke's face softened into a smile. Well, it's part of this estate in the Southampton. The owners decided to rent out the guest house. So we're on their property? He shook his head. It's a big lot, so we won't be on top of each other. It's a separate house, not an apartment over a garage or anything. It's set very far back from the road. You could walk around the estate without a car in sight. He looked at me directly. You need the fresh air. Sounds wonderful, I said, pretending to be excited. I'm curious as to why it's only coming on the market now. Luke shrugged his shoulders. Just timing and luck, I guess. Plus, all these hurricanes off the coast recently aren't shaping up to make a good summer. But the weather is going to be beautiful this weekend, and it's ours for the month if we want it. Luke was right. The weather today isn't anything but pleasant.
We step up to the wraparound porch supported by Corinthian columns with unobstructed views of the endless ocean ahead of us. White cumulus clouds float like whipped dollops in the sky to complete the picturesque scene. My eyes follow a boardwalk that edges the property and bridges over the thick covered dunes. Off to the corner, I notice a gas fire pit elevated on pavement stones with four white loveseat couches surrounding it, the dunes backdropping it into the perfect, picture-perfect scene. I even imagine myself and Luke snuggled up under a blanket on a cool night, the fire dancing in front of us, until my mind wonders what sort of creatures could be hidden beneath the brush. The backyard, while spacious and well manicured with corduroy lines of freshly cut grass, still doesn't feel as private as I would have initially thought. There is a garden hedge squared off in the middle of the property that seems to act as a privacy wall, but it can't be more than 100 feet, which on this property, as large as it is, doesn't do that much. Then again, it's obvious that the garden is meant more for a beautiful feature of the property rather than to act as a divide. I think about what Luke and I are paying for this rental, and it's much lower than anything else on the market, despite being 10 times nicer than anything else available. I wonder what the reason for it is. Are the pictures online for this property dated and we're in for a surprise? Or did something not work out with the previous renter? Then again, anyone, no matter how wealthy, can run into money troubles. The taxes alone on this place have to be astronomical. Maybe they need a quick fix. I follow the porch towards the backyard, descending from a set of stairs, bringing me towards the pool. It's large and rectangular with an elevated hot tub pouring in like a miniature waterfall. The white cushion loungers lounge the edge are perfectly even, and they were brand new, as if they were brand new and being staged for a photo shoot. I suddenly have the feeling like I'm being watched. I turn towards the main house, but I don't see anything at first. I still can't shake the feeling. My eyes flip back up, scanning the windows, until I notice the silhouette of a woman on the second floor. My body stiffens. After a moment, the figure steps back, the white curtain falling closed. The thought of being here, knowing someone might always be spying on us, sends a deep shudder through me, but I have to push the thought away. We need this to work. Are you okay if I go get the bags from the car, Luke asks? Of course. Luke gives me a quick smile. I look back up at the now empty window and suddenly feel vulnerable and exposed. I turn, scurrying back up the steps to check the door to the back porch, praying that it's open, my hands shaking as I try to grip the handle. I feel the pressure building in my chest as I struggle with the door. I need to be inside right now, but I can't seem to get my feet to listen. All I have to do is walk around the porch to the front, but I can't seem to do that. It's as if I'm frozen in place, the panic in me rendering my body catatonic, unable to move. I see a dark shadow on the other side of the glass door inside the house. It's approaching me, the outline I realize much larger than Luke. It comes up on me fast, ripping the door open angrily. My hand, still on the handle, jerks me and pulls me inside, causing me to fall into the figure. I let out a startled gasp as I feel a strong grip of seemingly large hands on my arms, holding me in a tight lock, unable to escape if I wanted to. The fear overwhelms me as I look up at the person in front of me. His face is slack with emotion. His dark eyes are deadened as if there is nothing behind them. His thick black eyebrows furrow angrily at me. I find my footing, eager to back away, but his grip remains tight on me. I struggle again, about to let out a scream loud enough for Luke to hear, when finally the man lets go of me and I step back, catching my breath. I notice then that he has to be at least 6.5 feet tall, taller than my 5'6" frame, or Luke's even 6. He appears older, early to mid-40s, but strikingly muscular. He's standing there, his squared off jaw tightly set, and there is a slight hint of a scowl like I'm an intruder in his house. Then suddenly it occurs to me that I might be. Maybe we have the address wrong. I swallow hard. I'm so sorry, I apologize. We were looking for the Wilson residence. We are supposed to be staying in their guest house. He crosses his arms, leaving his expression the same. This is the Wilson residence. His voice is deep and scratchy. Oh, I say confused. I'm Natalie. My husband Luke and I were told by Sadie Wilson that we could stay in this guest house for the month of... You shouldn't be here, he says, cutting me off. I blink in surprise. I'm sorry? Was there some sort of mix-up? He appears angry with me for asking the question. No. Okay. I try to keep my voice light. We stare at each other for a long moment. Can I help you? I hear Luke's voice behind him as he comes through the front door with our bags. He turns back towards Luke, his expression still the same. Then he lets out a long-winded exhalation from his nostrils as if frustrated. He turns back to me. Just get out, he growls, his breath hot on mine. Then he walks past me, slamming the back door shut.
And that was Courtney Pasak reading from The Hostess. All right, so we have a potential villain right off the bat. And of course, a lot of mystery, you know, what actually caused the accident, what you know, why is this house available? And so now the Hamptons, is this a place you're familiar with? Have you spent time there?
Not really. I mean, I've spent a couple days in Sag Harbor and maybe a day or two in Montauk off season, but it's, I grew up in New Jersey, so I grew up going to the Jersey Shore. But so it was funny when I went to the Hamptons, I went to Southampton for the Hamptons Whodunit. Once I landed, I took the car that I rented and I drove around to the places that I talked about in here to make sure that everything was accurate.
So why the Hamptons? Why set it there?
Just because I really enjoy the dynamic, you know, it's this sort of people idolize, you know, the wealth and privilege. And for some reason, you know, you walk into, like, if you were to walk into a rundown house and weird things were happening, like, you'd get out immediately. But for some reason, we all have this facade, like, well, if it's maintained and it's nice and it's expensive, like, oh, then everything must be fine, you know? Mm. And so it kind of creates this false sense of security.
And, you know, the fact that, you know, all of the characters are fairly well-to-do, but Sadie is extremely well-to-do, the hostess, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's quite a ways into the book before we really understand her background and, you know, everything that she didn't necessarily come from privilege.
Yeah.
And is there a message in that, you know, that you're...
You know, I kind of had just sort of this overall theme, and it was similar to The Tutor, where, you know, really it doesn't matter how well off you are or not. You really, no one can escape just basic human emotions. Like, there's no way to escape, you know, heartbreak and jealousy and insecurity. Like, it doesn't matter who you are or what you come from. We all have these natural emotions, and we're really not all that different from each other when you strip it down.
Right. Now, Sadie is she a psychologist or a psychiatrist?
Psychiatrist.
Psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and there's quite a bit of sort of, you know, that's actually an important feature of the book. So did you have to do some research to get, you know, to get the various things right?
Yeah, no, I certainly did a lot of research. And a friend of mine's an ER nurse, and I had also was able to kind of tap her and some of her friends that were in certain departments and kind of just say, like, if I have a scene that looks like this, like, how accurate is it? Does this seem off the top? What sort of medications would you give to someone that has this and this? And so, yeah, it was helpful to have all of that information because you want it to be as believable as possible.
Right, right. And for example, to know how long, like if somebody is kind of involuntarily committed,
mm-hmm.
how long they can be held for without it being, you know, all of those things.
Assuming. I called her back a couple times for that because there's different factors that can, she's like, well, if you have this sort of paperwork, you can extend it here. I'm like, okay, I don't know if I want to extend. Maybe we'll do this. So she was through all of that as well.
Okay. So you said, so the idea from this, you said kind of, you knew what the ending was going to be mm-hmm. before you started. And when that you're a fast writer. So how many drafts do you do?
So it really depends. So I kind of was, some people say I'm almost more like a script writer in the sense, even though I've never written a script before, because I write very bare bones, because the first thing I need to do is make sure that my plot makes sense and that there's no holes in it. So I tend to the first draft not waste any time on scenery and description, because, you know, if I have to kill my darlings, it's less painful that way. So the first run is just very straightforward, make sure everything makes sense. The next round will be focusing on the characters and making sure that, you know, their motivations are clear, that they make sense. And then the third is kind of, again, focusing on the description and the scenery. And even then, my agent was a former editor, so she'll look at it and she's usually the first person to be like, you forgot to describe what this place looks like here. I'm like, oh, right.
So okay.
She'll point that stuff out to me. So yeah, and I would say 3 or 4 drafts.
And you write,
and that's before it gets to an editor.
You write it in basically in the order that it appears in the book. Because I've talked to some writers who, you know, they know what scenes they're going to write and they don't necessarily write them in the order that they're going to be. They write them when they feel like it.
Oh, I jump around all the time. I use Scrivener because I love that I can do that. And actually, you know, like I said, because I wrote backwards in this, there was, you know, at one point I got to the dreaded middle and I'm like, all right, I've still got, you know, a certain amount of word count that I have to fill in here, but I don't want to, you know, the last thing you want to do is sag the middle, drag it on. Cause if you're bored, so is your reader and they're going to put it down. So I jumped. I go, all right, well, I know my ending. So why don't I write that? And then I wrote to the epilogue and then said, okay, well, what happened before that? What happened before that? And that also just inspired me to go, oh, I could foreshadow this in the middle. And then I go back to the middle and I write a chapter that foreshadows that. And then I went back. And so I jumped between the middle and the end until they kind of came in the middle.
So tell us a little bit about how Scrivener works for somebody who hasn't ever used it.
Yeah, so it's a writing tool that essentially, if you're the type of person that likes to outline with cue cards, like they literally have a section where you could do cue cards and write what your each scene or which character and move things around. You can switch off from having like a Word document set up to, you can break folders down into certain scenes. It gives you a lot of tools to work in whichever way makes the most sense. And then in the end, when you finish, you can compile everything and it will transfer it into a Word document. And then that is what you send to your agent and your editor.
Is formatting easier in Scrivener? Because I hate formatting in Word.
Me too.
Not that you necessarily have to do much as a, you know, for a manuscript, but.
Yeah. I mean, there are some times that I've compiled things and it's given me like all of a sudden there's a bunch of hashtags across the top and I'm like, where'd that come from? So I still run through it just to make sure there aren't weird glitches like that. But to be fair, I get those same sort of glitches with Word where it does it. So, I mean, I still prefer Scrivener and find that it works really well for the beginning process when you really are, you know, kind of trying to pull everything together. And then once you're in the straight editing part, you know, more of the formal line editing, I prefer Word.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Courtney Pasak, author of The Hostess. And this is the second of three books, although they aren't a series. So
yeah,
three books coming out very quickly. And I'm guessing that writing was really always something you wanted to do because you did get a degree in communications and journalism and then a master's in publishing. So mm-hmm. Were you writing all along, even before you published your first novel, self-published your first novel and then these?
Pretty much, you know, I was always huge into reading. And I remember when I was in second grade, we had library day. And the teacher, you know, the librarian read us a book and then she closed it and she said, you know, this was written by someone your age. And they blew my mind that a second grader could write and publish a book. So that kind of is what sparked that. I was like, I could start doing this now. I don't have to be an adult. So that was kind of where I started. So I'd always been writing. I threw obviously a lot out. And that's kind of, you know, that's how I kind of self-taught myself was, you know, you learn the structure and you figure out what works. And yeah.
So why did you go for the master's in publishing rather than creative writing?
So kind of the same reason that I went for communications instead of being a literature major, because communications would at least give me different, you know, various options from a job perspective. And The reason being is because I graduated in 2008 and financial crisis hit.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And that's why I went for publishing, because, you know, my communications major, I had options lined up, and then, you know, the magazine I was going to work for closed, it got shut down, and I lost that. And, you know, that's why I wound up working as a project manager at Nickelodeon, because I was a communications major. So my degree expanded on that. So that was why.
My daughter chose her college partially based on the fact that they had an actual major in magazine publishing, because she'd been the yearbook editor in high school for 2 years. She loved photojournalism. Mm-hmm. She loved doing the layout, you know, the whole thing. Nice. And the year, 6 months after she got to the University of Texas, they shut that major down.
So she
ended up with a major communications and corporate communications is what she ended up with. And now she's a CPA.
I know, right? Yeah. You go in all different directions.
Yep. And which she's very, very good at. She actually works for the company that I founded. It's, we're a manufacturing company. It's a good thing. But the whole is it even possible? Even publishing is a difficult thing to have a career in.
Yeah.
In this day and age. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but writers seem to still be able, there seems to still be a lot of demand for the written word.
Yeah. And we all do it, you know, most writers aren't doing it for the money. So you're doing it because you love it.
Yeah.
And appreciate, you know, reading books and So, I mean, there's definitely still demand for it. You know, there's the threat of AI coming in, but it's still, you know, you can tell what's formulaic and you can tell what really comes from the heart and what comes from true inspiration. And I think that's still obvious, you know, very obvious when you read.
I think so too. But then I wonder, like, I'm thinking it might not be such a bad thing if the human being wrote the whole plot, developed the characters, but there's certain scenes that you want to just speed write. But it might not hurt to use AI for a few scenes now and then. What do you think about that?
Then you run the risk of plagiarism because you don't know where it's coming from or how.
Oh, that's a very good point.
Other people as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but that's also why you read as, you know, you writers read as much as they write, because it gives them inspiration. Anytime I get stuck on something, I will go and read and I'll look at how they took a scene and that helps inspire me, like, oh, I could do something, you know, so it's the same, but, you know, but different, obviously, and you have your own original spin on it. And plus, right, you need to keep with your voice, because readers will pick up when it doesn't sound like, you know, doesn't sound like you.
Yeah. So do you have any trouble coming up with fresh ideas for the plots?
You know, it's one of those things. I think the most exciting and also most terrifying thing is when you write the end on a novel, because then you're like, oh my God, am I going to ever come up with another idea? But again, that's also why you read, because you get inspiration. And, you know, like, again, like with these rental homes and going, what sort of stuff's going on? You know?
Absolutely. Are there any other genres that you're interested in writing?
I really like mystery thriller. I mean, I enjoy romantic comedies. To be honest, I really haven't read them in a long time. I was always very intimidated with the bit of thinking I could write mysteries, because just how cleverly they have to be plotted out and the twist. But I think I've read enough and written enough that I've got a bit of a handle on it. So I really like being excited and working on that.
Now, I think you said there were a number of books that you wrote that you haven't published. Is that, did you mention that? Or
yeah, I threw them out.
You threw them out. So, so is there, you know, I always feel like, well, what a waste. Maybe you could redo them, could revise them, make them.
You know, if I thought, if I thought I could, you know, I would. I have one book in particular that I've shelved and figured, you know, I'm sure there's a way I could, this has potential. The others were just clearly predictable and formulaic, and you're kind of like, you know, it's a good startup. It's a good, exercise.
Yeah.
Best way to put it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just wasn't something
You know, it always reminds me of the story about Hemingway, who all of his, almost 100% of his initial years of work got lost because his wife was bringing it to him on the train, went out to get a sandwich, and somebody stole the box that it was in. And of course, this was back before copy machines. And so the only things that he still had were things that were out on submission. And it was a, you know, a great tragedy in one sense, and probably the beginning of the end of his, of that marriage. But he might not have been the writer he was if he hadn't basically had to start over after having had all that practice from the things that he lost.
Exactly. You know, I, for the third book coming out in June, I wrote that, you know, right after I had my second kid, and it was the COVID, and it was like kind of, I can do a little bit of this dabbling in between naps and things like that. And so I hadn't looked at that book for a while, and I've written two other books since, and started to finally get my own voice. And so my editor looks at it. She gave me some notes, but I looked at them quickly. I was like, okay, yeah, these aren't bad. And it was right when I was launching the tutor. So I was, you know, traveling to Tampa and Miami and a couple other places. But then I came back and looked at it, and I was like, oh my gosh, like I think I'm a much better writer than I was when I wrote this.
Oh.
And I need to, not that I had to redo it. I kept the story, but I just changed, you know, some of the formatting of it. There was a lot of chapters that just didn't go anywhere, that I think I was more focused on getting, you know, the word count up than supposedly moving the plot. So I was like, cut this, move this. And I was, you know, in order to stay on deadline, I was getting up at like 2 o'clock in the morning just to have 4 hours where there was no interruption so that I could just refocus this. And I did give my editor the heads up that I was doing this, so they were on board. So now they're in the process of reading those edits. So hopefully they're good with it. But like you said, like your writing changes so much. And the other thing, you know, when people say to me, I can't believe you threw your books out. I'm like, but it's also, you know, you think about it, like if every test you took, would you be confident with them being up for everybody to see when you weren't, if you didn't study that hard? Do you want people to go, oh, what was she thinking with that answer?
You
want to put your best self out there.
Right. Absolutely. So now I like reading thrillers too, and I read a lot of them, and I also watch a lot of them. Mm-hmm. Has there been any discussions about any of these books being made into movies or series?
So my agent has been shopping it around. We do have one production company that, you know, well, here's the thing. When it comes to Hollywood, in publishing, everything's a no until it's a yes, and everything in Hollywood is a yes until it's a no.
Oh.
So you kind of take everything with a grain of salt. So I do have a production company that is interested, that has said, we want to see a script. So we currently have a script writer working on that, but it's still very preliminary. And again, we see how things go. But I mean, it's a good time for writers, because between Colleen Hoover and Freda McFadden, like you know, Sophie Stava, so many people are getting picked up for shows and movies. So, you know, you hope for the best.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Do you have, would you have any particular actresses in mind for Natalie and Sadie?
Yeah, I haven't really thought about it. I feel like Nicole Kidman would be a good Sadie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All right, what about Natalie?
You know, I'm not really sure. Maybe like a Jennifer Goodwin.
Okay. Because
she could also pull off a very good pixie cut.
Ah, yes. That makes sense. How did you find your agent?
So I was, you know, it's funny. I never really looked into writers' conferences before. So I didn't realize until after I was agent, and that like, oh, I could go to these conferences and actually pitch someone face to face. That would be so much better. Instead, I was like cold emailing a bunch of agents. And I think I did like 143 or something crazy. And, you know, some got further than others, but ultimately in the end, it was a no. And then I started thinking, I was like, some of my favorite writers are like Ruth Ware and Lucy Foley and Jillian McAllister, and they're all UK based. And while the US has the biggest market, the UK has a really big mystery domestic thriller market. So I said, why don't I try that route? And that's how I came across my agent.
Okay, so your agent's British.
Yes.
Fantastic. Why do you think there's so many murders in the UK? Not literary murders. Yeah, literary murders.
Made everyone think they could get away with it.
I don't think they have that many actual murders, but I love watching all the BBC murder mystery shows. There's so many of them, and they're usually they often have three murders per episode, right? Mm-hmm. And like on Midsummer Murders and stuff like that, there's always three, or not always, but usually three. And they're all in these small towns. I'm like, how many people get killed off in these small villages in England?
I know. When people say like, so you're specifically domestic thrillers, it's like, yeah, you can only do so many neighborhood ones before you're like, yep, we should probably move.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. I always laugh too because like Murder, She Wrote, or a lot of these other ones where murders keep happening around these characters. Don't you think the police would eventually start to suspect the lay detective as, why are all these murders happening around him
you.
Or her?
Around you.
Yeah.
I give so much credit to those who write a series because again, yeah, you've got one person, and unless they're a cop or something, you know, again, why are all these murders happening around you
exactly.
in this small town?
Exactly. But you know, that's part of our suspension of disbelief, you know, that we're willing to accept that and for the character. Do you think you would ever write a series?
If I could come up with a good enough character, but kind of like you said, like I have a hard time finding like that, you know, that storyline that I can keep going. I do appreciate a series, but I'm always a fan of like wrapping everything up and right. get annoyed. And there's like, wait, I read this entire book and they didn't solve anything. So, and the same with a movie too, you know,
absolutely.
If it's something that I can binge to the next one, then it all will be forgiven. But yeah, so I liked, and the other thing too is I've put my characters, as you could see in the hostess, I put them through the ringer. So it's like, you almost feel like, oh God, what'd you do to her again? Hopefully one day.
How about detective fiction? Is that something you'd be interested in writing?
Possibly, but you know what? I don't have the confidence in doing understanding the procedure. I mean, I could do more research and things like that. Actually, with my third book coming out, my agent had said, you know, you really should give this FBI character a backstory. And I was like, I don't know anything about the FBI. Like, I don't want to mess things up and like get people mad. And it actually turned out that the security guard at my son's school, who also like taught him swimming, was an FBI, a former FBI agent. So I was able to talk to her. And so that was easy. Once I had that relationship, because then I could tell her what I was writing, and she was based in Miami. So she was like, yeah, this is the procedure. This is the protocol. They wouldn't be doing this. They'd be doing this. And then she also shared some like crazy stories. So I was like, is this going to be believable? And she's like, absolutely. Let me tell you what happened a couple weeks ago when I was talking to a friend of mine, they found this person in a refrigerator. I'm like, oh, okay. Then I guess what I'm doing is
that personal research is really the best, isn't it? Being able to talk to somebody with the real experience. You know, one time I interviewed a writer who, very beginning writer, very self-published writer, who, when I asked him about, and his stories were like military spy kind of things, mm-hmm. and I asked him about his research, and he said, oh, you can learn everything you need to on the internet. I'm like, not really. Not really. There's times where you have to have personal
connection. Yeah, like you said, it's just good to have a, if I had a connection with somebody, that would be helpful. Because, you know, again, with, one of my best friends is an ER nurse. So talking to her about all this psychological stuff was, you know, and then you finish that and you're like, and how are your kids? You know?
Yeah. And of course, Natalie, we talked about Sadie being a psychiatrist, but Natalie was an ER nurse or doctor.
ER nurse, which is what my friend was.
Yes. Yeah.
But even just like, okay, if I put her on this medication, is it believable that she'd have these side effects? And right. Do these side effects make sense? You know, that's right. The type of thing where maybe the internet would be right. I don't know if I'd really trust it. Like I was able to talk to somebody that would prescribe it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Courtney, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And we always close with the quote, and I decided I would do a quote on trauma and healing from Stephen Levine. To heal is to touch with love that which we previously touched with fear.
Oh, I should have ended the hostess with that.
I thought it was apropos.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
And of course, thank you.
See you all next week on Writers' Voices.